Developers. Welcome to the Basement Coders Podcast. We'll cover topics in development news and voice our opinions. The opinions we express are from on-the-ground experience, seldom in every tower to be found. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. However, if you are one who likes to give feedback or express your own opinion, please feel free to leave comments on our blog at basementcoders.com. That's basementcoders, one word, .com. Or follow us on Twitter at bcoders. That's spelled B-C-O-D-E-R-S. Thank you and enjoy.
Up next, it's our pleasure to bring a very special Basement Coders podcast live from San Francisco. We were given the opportunity to sit down with James Gosling, creator of Java. We do apologize for the background noise on this one. It was taped guerrilla style at a coffee shop in the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art during a busy lunch hour. But if you can filter out the noise, you won't be disappointed, as you'll get to learn some interesting facts about James, where he grew up, how his career took shape, and how Java was born. We also found out what James is up to these days and his thoughts on the current state of Java. Sponsorship for the Basement Coders podcast, as always, is provided by CrashPlan. $3.47 per month is worth it for your peace of mind. Your precious photos, documents, you name it, should be stored safely outside of your home. So visit CrashPlan.com to start safeguarding your data for free for 30 days with CrashPlan Central. If you'd like to enter for a chance to win a free one-year subscription to their completely secure CrashPlan Central offsite backup data center for as much data as you can throw at it, simply go to thebasementcoders.com/CrashPlan. That's one word. And follow the steps to enter. Today's episode is sponsored by Zero Turnaround, the guys who make JRebel. Never redeploy during development again. View your code changes instantly. This is badass. Visit them this week at Java 1 in the Hilton Exhibitor Center or at your leisure on the web at www.zeroturnaround.com/JRebel. Many thanks goes out to the server side for hosting today's podcast files. Go visit them on the web at theserverside.com, your Java enterprise community. And stay tuned as they will soon be posting a transcription of today's podcast. So, without further ado, we present our live interview with James Gosling. Enjoy!
All right, and we're back. We got a very special episode this time around. We have James Gosling, father of Java, and extraordinary in other areas as well. Thank you very much for doing a podcast with us.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Just to explain, you probably don't know who we are, but we're just a bunch of grassroots, you know, primarily Java developers. And, you know, we try and kind of try and take an organic approach to podcasting, not scripted, just, hey, who are you? How are you doing? You know, what do you think of this and that? So hopefully you're okay with that format.
Yeah, that sounds just fine.
Okay, great. I guess maybe you could just start with, I mean, not that everybody knows who you are, but kind of how did you start out? Did you, you know, where did you grow up? Where did you go to school? And then how did your career take you to this point?
I don't know. I mean, the whole life story in 25 words or less. Canadian, went to the University of Calgary, graduated from there, then went to Carnegie Mellon, got a PhD there. I grew up in Calgary, lived in Calgary until I was 22, and then I went off to get a PhD in Pittsburgh.
In computer science, obviously.
Yeah, in computer science, and ended up with a master's as well from CMU. And, you know, did a wide variety of consulting jobs and sort of some time off in the like a bigger job. And I eventually graduated in 83, went to work for IBM.
Oh, wow.
Which, you know, is, you know, in the top 10 of my stupidest careers.
I want to shake this guy's hand because I made that same mistake myself.
I think most of us here made that same mistake.
Yeah, he played in IBM too.
Yeah. Please don't tell us you actually wore blue suits.
Huh?
Please don't tell us you actually wore blue suits.
Oh, no. Oh, no. I did log way too many frequent flyer miles. They ended up working on this project that had people in San Jose, California, and Austin, Texas, and Stanford, Connecticut. And my office officially was in New York, even though I lived.
All right,
I lived in Pittsburgh, so I kind of actually lived on an airplane. But yeah, the stint with IBM lasted a year, at which point. One of the funny things was that when I went to go join IBM, I actually had another sort of offer. So I had actually had lunch with Andy Bechtolsheim the day he signed the papers with Scott and Vinod to create Sun. And so he was trying to get me to join Sun at the same time that the folks from IBM were and I would have been like employee number 4 or 5 or something. And, you know, I just sort of looked, Andy, you're a nutcase. You know, you're trying to do this with these Motorola chips that suck.
Right.
And IBM's got these great chips. They will kill you. And it's like, well, yes, the IBM CPUs and that were way better than the Motorola stuff, but all of IBM's guns were pointed at themselves. So my year and a half working at IBM was more of understanding how the Marx Brothers really worked.
That's awesome.
And so then, Bill Joy had been hammering on me pretty regularly to come and join Sun. Eventually, I gave in. So I started working Sun at 84, and yada, 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 here we are.
Right. Well, I brought this up actually when we saw you at the Thirsty Bear. It's kind of funny how we approached you because I'm the kind of guy where I don't know if this is my Canadianism, but I don't want to like intrude on people's personal space and stuff. Like I did want to introduce myself and stuff, but I wasn't necessarily thinking, oh, he's going to do our podcast. So what we did was we actually got a few of the guys' wives to approach you.
I saw that.
They
clearly weren't quite sure what they were doing or why they were doing it. They'd been put up to something, and it was like.
But you pulled out your phone, and you're like, "Yo, what time works for you? I'm good on Tuesday, and here we are." So that was great. So, just another Canadian thing. You got the Order of Canada, did you not?
I did. So, if only Canada were Britain, I'd be
Sir
James.
Oh, yeah.
But Canada like doesn't do the Sir thing, so I escaped that particular indignity.
That's great that somebody doing the Order of Canada nominations actually knew what Java was, and your contributions to computing. That's awesome.
What kind of perks does that give you in Canada?
You got to meet the Governor General.
Yeah, I got to meet the Governor General. That was probably
the total of it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, pretty much. Yeah. You end up with a really cool medal.
Okay.
And the studliness of going into the bars with the ladies.
Oh, yeah.
You got the bling on.
The funny part of it was that because I ended up with my face all over the newspapers in Canada because of that, even though there were several people who got the order in Canada at the same time. But when the Governor General is kind of short, so when she lifted the thing to go over my head, I kind of like crouched down and I did kind of a funny thing, and it made her just howl. She just broke down and laughed, and she had this like great laughing expression on her face. And so they selected that, you know, all the newspapers selected the picture based on her expression, and I was like, okay,
that's funny.
Now, was Java a strategic thing for Sun, or was it an experiment? Just basically, do what you can. You know,
I call it a strategic experiment.
Okay, that worked out.
And it actually worked out in a direction that was sort of unexpected. Right? So, you know, at the beginning, it was a group of kind of disgruntled Sun engineers who were sort of going, you know, we're missing the boat on X, Y, and Z. We'd like to go off in a corner and just think about stuff. And, you know, we had a list of things that felt like we were missing the boat on, and Scott sort of went, yeah, that makes sense. Okay. So we went off and we sort of did our, we did like, you know, that was this thing called the Green Project, right? We did like a whole bunch of things on it. And the only thing that actually survived from the Green Project was the bit that I did, right, which was the software development and stuff. But, you know, we built this really neat little handheld. And, you know, that was in 1992. The state of the art for the hardware to build that kind of stuff is pretty shaky. But compared to the other stuff that we had been built, it was extraordinarily cool for the day.
What did it do?
It had an LCD touchscreen. It had a fairly wicked processor on it. It had a very early version of Editor 11, because the Editor 11 spec wasn't really out yet. It was actually these really funky military radios.
Sounds like a Sunspot.
No, it was actually a MicroSpark.
There you go.
I actually had a MicroSpark CPU. We were actually running Solaris on the thing.
Really?
You know, that's one of the things that I sure wish we had kept on.
Yeah.
One of the odd twists of fate is that some of the folks who did the hardware for that handheld for Sun.
Yeah.
I'm actually not familiar with it. It's a Sun Spark. You mean like the actual machine?
Yeah, the CPU that exactly had a Spark.
Right. Okay.
We had started doing these MicroSpark chips, which were very low power, very small Spark chip.
Okay.
But a couple of the engineers who had actually built that handheld were deeply involved in the iPad.
Yeah.
You know, so in an odd sort of twist of fate, right, the iPad is kind of an evolution. They kind of fed together. We had at that time been really concerned about, you know, what was going on in the consumer space, what was going on with desktops. CPUs were showing up in all kinds of surprising things that most people in the computer world were just ignoring.
Yeah, right.
And
it was all about big rack servers at that point, right?
Well, at that point, yeah. the big racks were just kind of, yeah, it was all big rack servers, but different than the big racks today.
Right.
But by the time that, you know, 95 rolled around, you know, there was this huge industry-wide problem with Microsoft. And so the strategic reasoning and focus shifted from, you know, the boat that we were missing over here to the, you know, huge attack we were getting over there.
Mm-hmm.
And various folks realized that, you know, this one corner that we had used in this piece, we could actually sort of repurpose it in dealing with the Microsoft threat. You know, that was the whole Java launch, getting people like IBM and Oracle to sign on to support it. That was the rocket.
Yep. Right?
But, you know, so, you know, it was a very strategic thing for Sun in 95 when we launched it, but it was also a strategic thing in 92 when we started the experiment. It was just strategic in kind of a different direction.
Well, you talk about strategy. So, Craig has stated, we're all kind of coders. We're all contributors to the community, to the Java community. I think all of us have somewhat made a career off of Java and our contributions. I work very closely with Apache. I commit to several projects. I pretty much put my whole career on it. And this big acquisition came, and there was a lot of questions as to where's it going to go? Where's Java going to go? And it's no secret, and you know, if you can't answer anything, feel free not to, but feel free to speak your mind here. The whole free Java, we get it. We understand that. Especially me coming from the Apache side, you know how, I'm not speaking for Apache, but I work very closely with the JCP and the JSRs, and I'm on a couple of the expert groups on there, and I know that there's been a lot of stress, so to speak.
Right.
The acquisition came. There's a lot of fear in the community. There's a lot of mistrust in the community. We noticed you left. And we noticed your pretty cool t-shirts that you got going there. Tell us about all that. Tell us what your thoughts are, and how does that ring into the way we feel as, you know, the contributors to a lot of this open source software that we base our careers on. What's your thoughts on all that?
Well, the t-shirt has been kind of fun.
Yeah.
I have yet to see anybody wear one. Because around here
they've been taken care of by the Oracle employees already. That's why you haven't seen it.
Oh yeah, I know. I mean, the various Oracle employees have been instructed to like not touch them.
Yeah.
And you know, and I've noticed that this is a great t-shirt to wear.
Yeah.
In big crowds around here, because the seas just part.
Yeah.
You know, people just sort of go, oh, I don't want to be near that. Which is, I find, really funny. Right? And, you know, the whole free Java thing is kind of a weird history, because, you know, Sun, you know, from like day zero was basically an open source kind of company. And, you know, the whole weirdness that we had about open source was not a weirdness about open source per se, but a weirdness about some of the actors in the dance,
yeah,
in the drama.
Yeah.
You know, so when the Start the Java Foundation thing happened in 2007, but one of the things you have to understand was that was all entirely orchestrated by Oracle.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, Oracle, they wrote, I mean, you know, that bizarre clause that went into that one set of meeting minutes. They wrote that. They went around to everybody in D.C.
and said,
you know, it is the sense of the executive committee that Java would be, the Java community would be best served by the establishment of a Java Foundation with this and that.
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, so if you're
sort of an open source contributor participant like you are, that all sounds really good. And actually it sounded, you know, fundamentally we agreed with that. The problem was that it was A, driven by Oracle, who whose motives were, you know, more than slightly not what you wanted them to be. And, you know, they had strong-armed a bunch of people into signing in ways that made them uncomfortable. You know, some folks like IBM, I mean, IBM's been kind of weird on the whole topic because on the one hand, they'd like to do anything they can to screw Sun over. I mean,
right.
You know, they didn't name Eclipse casually.
I was surprised that they weren't the ones that bought it. I just thought that would be a lot. That made a lot of sense.
Yeah.
They have so much invested in whatever.
I don't know. I mean, you know, the little bits I do know are you know, they were being very cagey about issues around antitrust, and that made the board nervous. You know, when the Sun's board was controlled by an extremely small number of institutional investors. And so it was really the institutional investors who were driving everything. The sale had nothing to do with, you know, the business or what would be good for the employees or any of that. It was totally, you know, a bunch of investment banks needing liquidity. They were looking for the best terms of the most certain money. And so how it all really came down, I really don't know. I'm deeply thankful that I was not in those rooms at the time, because it's just not something that's fun. But, you know, it's just the way the world goes. But, you know, the whole thing around the Java Foundation 3 years ago, it was totally, you know, this sort of really snarky backroom deal orchestrated by Oracle, right? And you know, I have no illusions about Oracle ever actually living up to their words, because this is Oracle we're talking about.
Right.
But I find it, you know, deeply amusing, right, that they were really snarky about this 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And now that the shoe's on the other foot, they go, no!
3 years ago, they didn't own Java.
Well, exactly. They didn't own Java, but it just points out that I don't know how to say this other than, you know, they were lying duplicit as shits 3 years ago. And, you know, they you know, basically by their turnaround, they're basically admitting that, right? And you know, Oracle's kind of a funny company because they actually glory in that.
Yeah.
You know, they have no issues with being categorized that way. Some of their PR people might get a little uncomfortable, but up at the top, they don't give a thing. They deeply, deeply don't give a shit.
Yeah. But what's big developers, and because we've all had so much investment in our careers, and we saw the acquisition occur, we saw you exit, which kind of scared everybody. Everyone said, wow. Yeah, I mean, and we're seeing a lot of really strong Oracle folks who are good, solid folks jumping ship, moving on. A lot of really good people who contribute a lot to the community.
Yeah.
Seeing a lot of folks moving on. Then all of a sudden, we see this lawsuit come down the pipeline, and everyone's like, you just attacked probably one of the biggest contributors to the Java community, Google. What are you thinking? Now, with that being said, Oracle's got a great Android app you can download for Java 1, so I'm not getting that one. But what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, with Oracle, it doesn't have to make sense.
Yeah.
Right? It just has to make money.
Yeah.
Right? You know, that's kind of the only game they're in.
Right.
Right? And, you know, I think, you know, one of the important things for the community to remember is that Oracle is deeply, deeply dependent success of Java. Some really huge fraction of their business. Now, all of their fast growing parts of their business are formally based on Java. So, you know, there are really serious limits on how weird they can get. And also, you know, Oracle isn't a monolith. I mean, it's more monolithic than many companies because, you know, the LPOD kind of micromanages things pretty severely. But there are a lot of really good people at Oracle. You know, and they know what the right thing to do is.
Right.
You know, they may be constrained by, you know, the business folks and the rest of it, but there are a lot of people whose hearts in the right place and will do whatever they can to do the right thing.
What's your thoughts on the lawsuit, the whole Google thing? What's your thoughts on what you think's behind that? What do they? I think that's the biggest
question. It's a lot of money. Yeah. There's nothing else in there. I mean, you know, at Sun we had done an analysis and said, yeah, there's a bunch of patents being violated here.
Is it because of the encroachment on, like, maybe
it was just you know, are there patents being involved? You know, the legal guys do these evaluations all the time.
Right.
And you know, we've been through a lot of patent cases, a lot of court cases, and we really hate it. Litigation. It's a waste of time. It's really, really expensive. It's usually a PR nightmare. And, you know, when the other side is, you know, the universe's love child, you know, it's an especially large PR nightmare. So we, you know, it was like, you know, this is the Google guys are being a little weird, but they're also being a little good. And, you know, so it add up the balance. But you know, the Oracle guys wrote, licensing opportunity.
Right. And you think that's what they're going for, is trying to force a hand to make Google somehow pay up a license? Because here's the fear. The fear is, if they went after Google for that, what are they going to do with, like, Apache, for example? I mean, in theory, there's a lot of software, maybe like Harmony, that's being used quite significantly in the Android components.
Yeah, I mean,
isn't that a threat on open source?
Really, really unlikely. I think that the Sun had done essentially licensing deals with Harmony. So I think that they're pretty covered for it. You know, whereas Google just kind of went interesting.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm fairly sure that, you know, the Oracle lawyers probably did their homework. Oracle actually hires good lawyers. And since Android is open source, you know, you just look at the code. You know, pattern match code against cat. You know, they probably did that.
Yeah. Well, was it your blog that there was a statement, I don't know if it was from your blog, about when the deal with Sun and Oracle was going through, that
the Oracle lawyer's
eyes lit up?
Yeah, that was my blog.
Yeah,
that was my blog, the whole thing about their eyes lighting up. And they really did.
Yeah.
You know, they were like, ooh. You know, because lawyers just like to make revenue.
Right.
And I'm sure that they were looking at, like, the patent cross license fees that we were getting from Microsoft, you know, because, you know, Microsoft got mad. It just smears over a huge pile of Sun patents.
Wow. Yeah.
Because when they did the .NET design, they basically cut and pasted from the Java spec. And the way that they did the
CLR. Right. You know, they swizzled the way the instruction set worked, but the way this thing really operated, it was just like they exercised essentially no creativity in coming up with that. You know, they've done some things since then that have been kind of interesting, but you know, as part of the, you know, the various court cases, you know, we end up with this rather odd patent deal with them that involved them, you know, paying us fairly tasty amounts of money.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that the Oracle lawyers kind of looked at the Microsoft numbers and said, yeah, we want that from Google.
Now that makes sense.
And that's just a random guess. But that would be their opening shot.
Do you think the case has merit, like legally speaking?
I would guess that the Oracle lawyers did their homework. They almost certainly, you know, I mean, because Android is open source, it's really easy for the Oracle lawyers to go out and hire, you know, third-party experts to do the comparison. So they probably actually have a fairly solid case. I mean, this is one of the reasons that hardware manufacturers often don't open source their drivers. Right? It's because if they open source their drivers, then other hardware manufacturers can look at that and go, oh, your hardware must, you know, stomp on this patent device.
That's very interesting.
Right, and I've had more than one hardware manufacturer tell me that was the deal.
That's interesting. Huh. Now, your t-shirts set Java free. There's a vendor, I won't say who got in trouble for putting out these really cool t-shirts in the vendor center, and on the back it says, you know, set Java free or something.
Just free, yeah.
Yeah, and Oracle
Java came in. Just free.
Java just free. It's very cool. And Oracle came in and said, no, you're not giving those away.
So people got the kids.
A few people went around there and kind of under the table were able to obtain them. We saw a lot of people do that. Walking around with them, and so obviously they're very sensitive about it. Tell us about that initiative and what do you want to see for Java?
I think it's really funny how sensitive the Oracle guys are and the lengths to which they have gone to, you know, suppress any of this stuff. I mean, it's pretty funny. I mean, the fact that Oracle employees have been told to not talk to me is, like, really funny. And of course, that actually hasn't stopped Oracle employees from talking to me, right? They just kind of, like, walk up to me and say, you know, I'm not allowed to talk to you. This is the latest stupid thing they've done. And, you know, what should happen going forward? You know, it needs responsible stewardship. I'm actually perfectly happy with Oracle continuing. So long as they act responsibly towards the community, right? And there have been recent incidents where they have not done that. Right? There have been a variety of things like, you know, Open Solaris. I mean, Open Solaris was just a clusterfuck for the community.
Yeah,
it was.
You know, I mean, it was just horrible. Stuff they did around things like OpenSSL, you know, various identity management things, which is horrible. I think they're much less likely to do that to Java, but it's going to require the community to keep up the pressure. A trajectory that went down, you know, creating a foundation that could be good, it could be a nightmare. I mean, that, you know, the computer industry has a history of foundation. And some work out well. I think the average one has just turned into a political nightmare. Things like the OSF and that were just like,
are they still around?
Yeah, they're still around, kind of. But you know, one of the problems with a foundation like that is that you know, if you set them up as like the people who handle the engineering, and then you've got a bunch of companies that contribute to it, they'll do that while it's politically expedient. And then it just sort of goes away. And there's kind of nobody who's kind of life is on the line for any of that. So at some level, I don't care what direction it goes, just so long as it's as the community is well served. And Oracle could do that. In my little, just create a campaign, I have no illusion. But it's all about just letting them know we're paying attention.
Have they tapped on your door legally in any sense of saying, watch what you say?
There's nothing they can actually do.
Right.
As far as I know, so long as I don't lie.
Exactly.
Even if I lie, given what happens to, like other folks who lie in the press, I mean, nobody's nailed Glenn Beck, so.
What would they have to do specifically to still remain good stewards of Java? Because I actually had the thought whenever Oracle announced its acquisition, and it was finalized after EU approval, was that, well, this could be good in some ways because they'll finally have like someone that can light a fire under the pants of some people, of some projects, and get things going.
You can say the word ass.
Well, yeah, and so long as they do that, the development of Java is not an inexpensive thing. It takes a fair amount of funding. But it's not just about writing the code. Writing the code is like 2 or 3% of the expense. When you're shipping like 15 million copies a week, just the bandwidth is horrible. The QA, when you have to worry about something that has security issues, right? When you've got everything, every stock exchange, every phone company on the planet, their security depends on the Java account. So it's not a casual piece of testing. And when it comes to like open source contributions, our history with contributions over the years has been kind of snarky, in that we would get lots of people sending us code and bug fixes and such. But on average, we'd get a submission that had fixed a bug, but it caused 3 or 4 more. And it probably didn't fix the bug for everybody. It only fixed the bug for their one case. Trying to get people in the community to actually think about the whole code base and not just their particular issue today. Doing a one-line change ends up requiring an immense amount of testing.
Yep.
source projects are way too casual for that. And you know, sometimes when you get bugs that are, you know, potential security issues, you have to move fast. You have to put immense resources on getting it done. And yeah, maybe it's just like one engineer, you know, fixing one character in one line. But, you know, then testing it on 10 platforms, making sure that you can actually produce a bug. The harder stuff is, you know, if you have a bug, there are probably people out there who have worked around that bug. And how many of the workarounds are you going to break? Somewheres in the, you know, 9 to 10 million developer community out there with enormous applications. You know, trivial fixes are not trivial.
Exactly.
Right, and so, you know, open source projects, the way that the average open source project is constituted, it's really easy to get people to do the fun stuff. Right? And it's really hard to get people to do the hard stuff.
Yeah.
Right.
Or the boring stuff.
Like documentation.
Or like, you know, QAing the math library.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. You know, doing, you know, QA on sine and cosine. Right. You absolutely have to have a PhD in mathematics. And you know, sine and cosine sounds really simple. Unbelievable depths of subtlety in there. There are extraordinarily few people on this planet who are qualified in QA sine and cosine.
And that's key. I mean, when you get the Department of Defense probably bets their trajectories on those, right? And if you get one off a little bit, oops.
Yeah, and you know, so you mean that particular case is one that I've been drawn into over and over again for years, because you know, people do benchmarks of sine and cosine in Java on Intel chips compared to C. And we beat C in almost everything except benchmarks that require sine and cosine. And it's like, what's going on? Right? Well, turns out there's a small issue with the way that the sine and cosine hardware is implemented in spec on the Intel platforms. And we actually work around it in software. We, you know, the ranges from plus or minus 5, we're pretty close to the Intel speeds. You get the larger values where the Intel thing rips. And so like for lots of folks who do math on the Java platform, because we actually do it accurately, we actually like put a lot of effort into, you know, you know, the fact that we actually cared about that chip. Lots of people depend on it, but it's not the kind of thing that, you know, just, you know some, you know,
Joe Hacker
is going to do.
Yeah.
Right? You know, so, and it costs actual money. And so, you know, having somebody like Oracle, can actually be a really, really good thing. You know, foundations tend to have issues with funding things on that kind of scale. And Oracle can probably do the right thing. The problem is that their sort of genetic code, their sort of behavioral genetic code, is not that good.
Yeah. Technology right now excites you? I mean, what's out there right now that you look at and say, wow, that's some cool stuff?
Well, there's a lot of cool stuff. You know? So, I'm kind of all over the map on what's cool.
Mm-hmm.
Right, the project I've been, you know, helping out on lately is this control system for an Audi TTS. you know, things like Cassandra and Voldemort, you know, some of the NoSQL databases. I've never got it when it comes to SQL databases. It's like, why? You know, just give me a hash table and a shitload of RAM, and I'm happy.
Right.
You know, and then you do something to deal with failures. And you look at the way that the things like you know, the whole NoSQL movement is. It's a various flavors of large-scale distributed hash tables, and trying to deal with massive scale, massive replication world of you know, you can't back up the database because no tick farm is big enough for it, right?
Yeah.
And you know, understanding that scale and reliability actually fit together, but you can solve both problems at the same time. So a bunch of those things are really, really cool. I'm actually pretty excited about the way, you know, there's this sort of pragmatic evolution of the open source movement that's happening. There's kind of a religious fanatic side of the open source movement that's sort of, you know, information just wants to be free.
Yeah.
It's like, look, guys, you know, I'm an engineer. I don't want to be an engineer as a hobby. I don't really care about being fabulously wealthy, but I just, you know, I've got to be able to, like, some of the open source zealots, their view is kind of like, you've got to be a waiter during the day and an hacker at night. And it's like, no, that doesn't work.
Yeah.
Right? But, you know, there's this sort of pragmatic flow that goes, you know, what's really valuable about open source is not the word, is not the free as in Peter, but free as in speech.
Yeah.
And the collaborative development model.
Exactly.
And then figuring out, if you're going to collaborate, you know, like companies collaborating in a non-open source way, the legal frameworks for them end up being nightmares. And then if things go snarky, they're nightmares.
Yeah.
And you know, the standard open source licenses are one of the few ways to make collaboration actually work. Right? But if you do that kind of collaboration, then and you make it open source, then how do you pay salaries?
Yep.
And you know, in the enterprise world, it's been working out really nicely because service and support and that is where the money really is. And you know, at Sun, we had gone open source for everything because we kind of came to realize that, you know, when you do a licensed software product, you get revenue from the license, but you've also got expense in selling. You know, the kind of marketing and all this other stuff that you do around selling is pretty large.
Much of overhead, yeah.
You know, there's a lot of overhead in schmoozing customers and all the rest.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, those two kind of cancel out.
Yeah.
Well, and that's like, I was going to ask, I was a Visual Basic programmer coming right out of school. You don't have to feel sorry for me, but I understood how Microsoft made money. And then Java came along. And I went, how is this working? Aren't you a commercial company? You know, obviously I know now, but it took me that much to kind of understand that. How was it explaining that to the powers that be at Sun? Like, did they get it right?
Well, at Sun at the time,
yeah.
You know, think of like the revenue from something.
Yeah.
You know, it's this long expression with a lot of terms that get added together.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of them is a license. But you know, one of the terms at the time, 15 years ago, was that every software vendor had decided that the only platform they could support was Windows NT. Right, so all the people who were writing software for Sun Systems 15 years ago were telling us, no, we can't do this anymore. Even though, you know, you guys have a much better platform, they've got better volume. But IBM was getting the same message, DEC was getting the same message, everybody was getting the same message in the software that they were shutting down development on everything except NT. For a company like Sun at the time, the equation was basically, if we don't do Java, if we don't give software developers a way to develop software for our platform without shutting themselves out from NT, then they're just going to abandon us and we're dead. So it was this kind of negative turn in the whole thing that drove the drove working out then. And so in the enterprise world, the open source works really well. The place where it falls apart, though, is for sort of desktop software.
Yeah.
On the one hand, I really love, GIMP and Blender. On the other hand, the GIMP and Blender guys, it is total volunteerism. With desktop software, my personal view is if the desktop software requires a support phone call, you have to fail.
Agreed. Absolutely.
And so in that world, this whole service and support model just doesn't work. It just can't work.
Right.
One of the reasons that I was trying to get the Java store done in Sun was to make there be a way for people doing desktop software. And actually, the original versions of the Java store would support not just Java code, but any kind of code. In fact, the whole inner infrastructure was about anything.
Yep.
We ended up concentrating on delivering Java code for a sort of awkward reason, which is that if you're delivering software to people, you are implicitly taking on some liability, because if the thing you deliver destroys their machine, then you've got some liability.
Yeah.
If people are contributing stuff to the store, how do you know that it's good stuff versus some rogue and malignant thing?
That's some of the challenge like the Google Android store was having.
Right. And the thing about about delivering Java code is if you do it right and you get the sandbox right, and yada, 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 then we can actually make fairly strong statements about how much damage this thing can do. Right? And so the way that the store was working was that you could either go through a rigorous testing program and get the locks taken off the sandbox, or you could deliver whatever you wanted, but it had to have some locks on it. Right? And going on the rounds with the lawyers, that worked out. That's kind of where we had to go, and we really couldn't do that for sort of non-Java code, although we were trying to figure out how to do that. But one of the sad things about Android was they really didn't pay attention to security issues as much as they should have. Google's kind of a funny company because they, a lot of them have this kind of peace, love, and happiness version of do no evil. By being like overly peace, love, and happiness, and the whole world is peace, love, and happiness, they end up doing evil. Right? Because they don't,
they really didn't spend enough time thinking about, you know, there are actually nasty people out there.
Yeah, for sure.
And, you know, I mean, Google puts a lot of effort into security and things like Chrome.
But they're pretty good at watching everywhere you go, aren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I have this sort of love-hate thing with Google these days. And, you know, they can get kind of creepy.
They can't. Do you use the browser plugins that prevent the ads and block some of the analytics stuff?
No,
you just let it, anything goes on your browser.
We're all geeks.
We all use the ad blocker software.
Well, I sometimes do. I mean, I used to do them all the time, but I do that more because I didn't like the really obnoxious ads.
Oh yeah, the ones that would pop up and flash a monkey.
And you know, the personal privacy stuff, I'm just like, you know, blocking their ads is not going to block, you know, they're going to find out something.
They're going to find some other way, and they do. They continually change it.
Yeah, they you know, so it's one of those, you know, give up, you know, your life is over. You know, if you actually want personal privacy, the only thing you can do is disconnect. You have to go, you know, live in some obscure valley in New Zealand.
I think that's what I've heard, is you need to go somewhere in New Zealand in order to find your way to keep yourself from Google watching you.
You have to be in a cave so you're out of reach of a satellite. And,
yeah, exactly.
You know, if you need to spend money, it has to be cash.
But it is creepy. It is creepy.
Yeah. It is getting very, very creepy. Yeah.
So you wrote a great post about that, the Star Trek versus Blade Runner.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought that was a very apt comparison, because of those two very distinct views of the future.
Right. And
utopian dystopian.
Yeah. And you know, the thing is that the future isn't something that's rammed down our throats. The future is a choice, right? And the human race is, you know, 6-7 billion odd people, each of which is making choices every day. You add up all those choices, and that's the direction of humanity.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, so each of us has fairly small voices, but, you know, you add up a lot of small voices and you get big voices. And for people who are, you know, in positions where they're kind of molding a lot of the core pieces, like, you know, computer software, you know, people keep hearing people say, oh, it's all over, you know, the internet's here, we're done. Why do we need software? It's like, guys, we have hardly even started.
Just started, yeah.
And, you know, so, you know, as you know, every last hardware engineer on this planet has a huge impact on the future. Way out of proportion to the fact that they're, you know, one in billions.
Yeah.
Every software developer has been granted a lot more votes than one. You know, so vote wisely.
Absolutely.
You know, and, you know, personally, I'm not a, you know, I like Blade Runner, the movie.
There.
I just don't want to live.
Don't want to live there, exactly.
Keep it fiction.
Yeah. What's your thoughts on the other languages that are going on JVM, like the Scalas?
I was wanting to ask about that too.
What's your thoughts on that? How do you feel about all that? The innovation.
I'm a big fan.
Great.
Do you use any of them personally?
A little bit. I can't say I use them a lot. I mean, the original Java design, you know, was not, you know, because I thought, you know, that was like the perfect language. You know, the whole, you know, design construct there was about trying to be comfortable for existing C and C++ developers so that they could look at Java code and go, yeah, that's something I could be comfortable with.
technical languages like Clojure. Mm-hmm. You know, Clojure's got a lot of coolness about it. It's one of these, you know, not for everybody things.
Do you have any preference on one? Anyone you like more over the other?
Scala, probably. Scala? You know, my big problem with Scala is that the type theory has gotten really complicated.
Yeah.
And
the language lawyers are driving the bus.
Yeah, the language lawyers are driving the bus. Sort of turned into something that sort of journeyman developers and people like me. I mean, I sort of start getting into the Scorpus and the Scala spec, and my little head starts to spin, and I go, what?
I think it's good, these languages are good for Java. Well, it takes a lot of the burden off of Java, the language, because everybody wants to just kitchen sink and Java, the language. But it's like, now you can run on the JVM and you can have all those nice things.
Well, that was one of the key points behind the JVM. I mean, everything I actually care about is in the JVM.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
The JVM has worked out really, really well. And one of the things that in past lives that had always really bugged me was you'd have like two different languages on a system, and there was no way to get them to communicate. And the great thing about doing languages on the JVM is that the task of getting them to work together is really easy. I was talking a while ago with a guy who had done an ML compiler. An ML is this weird-ass language that does theorem proving. And if you're doing something that looks like theorem proving, it's great. If you're trying to put up the dialogue box, it's really bizarre.
Yeah.
And yet, in sort of pure ML, that's what you got to do. And in ML, you do ML for the theorem proving, and Java code for popping up the dialog boxes, and life is a whole lot simpler.
Yep.
It just works.
So now that you've left Oracle, what's the future of you? Where are you? What's up next?
What am I doing?
Yeah, what are you up to?
And I'm driving out, of course.
Yeah.
Well,
is it all yachts and camping? Or?
No, I mean, I unfortunately did not sell stock when I should have.
Been there, done that.
Yeah. So I'm not in yacht class. I actually have to do something about a job one of these days. Making a little money doing speaking engagements and things like that.
I'm sure there's no shortage of job offers.
Yeah, and then it turns into this, well, what do I want to do when I grow up? Deeply confused about that. Part of the problem is that there are just a whole lot of things that are really, really cool. There's a part of me that loves the embedded world. There's a part of me that just loves the scientific computing world. When I look at what people are doing with some of these large scale, the NoSQL stuff, a lot of that stuff is like really, really cool. Before I was talking to you guys, I was just over there talking to the Fortron folks. And, all the stuff that they're doing with OpenSSO and that. And that's just, really fucking cool.
Yeah.
And, you look at the social media space, right? And some of them are really pretty cool. Some of them are getting a little creepy, but some of them are really cool.
Yeah, yeah. Like linking your credit card to your social network.
Yeah.
You're buying this.
Things like I'm really happy with LinkedIn. They seem to be doing a pretty good job of being respectable on that scale. The Facebook guys are kind of creepy.
They've gone off the deep end, I think.
Yeah. And then things like Zynga. nice thing ever. You know, it's probably one of those, you know, I'm in the wrong Myers-Briggs quadrant things.
Absolutely.
People seem to be in love with Farmville,
and I'm
just confused by Farmville.
I hear you there.
I'm not six things.
Yeah.
Completely off of that. Have you dealt much with any contributing and stuff? Just because I think that's a really cool thing where you basically infer an API in front of hardware resources. Have you done anything in that realm? Contributing.
Well, certainly all of the large scale database stuff is that. I was really pissed off at Larry's rant about how stupid cloud computing.
Well, he actually
and then at his keynote
this last week,
he was like 180 degrees. Make up your mind.
Well, I took from his original rant though was that the firm was so nebulous and it was basically taken over by marketing folks. And but at the same token, they're probably pushing out their own things and calling it cloud. So yeah, that does stink. But ultimately, I think they got it.
There was a piece of me that kind of agrees with that.
Yeah.
But in some sense, cloud computing is what people used to call a grid.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
Which was a cool name.
Grid plus sort of deployment management and sort of open access. In the early grid days, one of the things that people would often do is sort of require uniform structures. So you would take one thing and deploy it to the grid, and you had to have 64 CPUs exactly the target type. And if you didn't have 64, they didn't all have the same memory, then, you sprinkle some virtualization dust all over the thing, and you can make clouds out of, the CPUs in your teapot.
It's like you're saying, you're giving software developers more choices, and basically, you're putting out the old bastard operators from hell who are in charge of the hardware. Now that the developers end up being able to control the hardware resources. It's a great movement.
I'm basically really happy with the cloud world. Personally, I don't dabble with it very much, only because building a cloud to dabble with costs actual money.
Yeah, true. Yeah. Very true.
Amazon EC2 is kind of cool. But you don't get to dabble with that for long before it gets a little expensive.
Yeah, but the cheapest you're going to get is $70 a month, and for a lot of people that's not trivial.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah.
It's true. Well, I think we're up on an hour. We don't want to take up too much more of your time, but
before we go, we have a present for him.
That's true. Yeah, we have a basement t-shirt. T-shirt.
Once you're done with your campaign.
Yeah.
This is
there's actually a saying on the back.
This is our saying that we have.
Stay geeky, woo, my friends.
So on behalf of the basement board, we really appreciate this opportunity.
Okay.
Thank you for what you've done for us.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, appreciate it.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Basement Coders, and as always, we invite you to come to our blog at basementcoders.com. That's basementcoders, one word, .com. Or follow us on Twitter at bcoders. That's BCODERS. Thank you again, and until next time.